I could still run, I'd be out yonder taking off from right here right now, I'll tell you that. Boy, I tell you what, hearing somebody talk about you like that, you know, I got, who is that guy she's talking about, you know?
As long as you're talking to the mic, Jim.
I'm going to try to.
I know you're hard
to hear. I do like Damon does. Y'all don't blame him, Miguel, for me being up here, and he don't even show. How about that chicken? What a place. I'm Jim Thomas. I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I say my last name is because when I first came into this program, I was on visit a guy up there in the hospital, a good friend that I've been sitting next to in the meetings. So I go up to the reception, and I said, I want to see George. She said, George who? I said, I don't know who George is. She said, I'm not going through all the names, you know, on this list and all this kind of stuff. We've got hundreds of people on here, you know. So I didn't get to see George then until later. But anyway, I protect other people's anonymity, and I believe in it strongly. But what a place. I love this place. I've been around for a long time, as she said. And I just can't begin to tell you, you know, what it's meant to me to be around. Let me read you something that I come across while I was just thinking about doing this talk. And I was calling some old friends just that had come to mind when I was going through some of my records and all. And I was just telling them how much I appreciated their friendship over the years and how much it meant to me. But I just come across this, and I wrote it years and years ago, and I don't know exactly what the occasion was, but what a privilege it's been to have been a part of this program. I often reflect on the kindness I've been shown and the wonderful people that I've been associated with over the years that float through my mind at times. I'm alone a lot in quiet times and things like that, and these names come through my head. What an impact they've had on me. We look at newcomers and see our past, and we wish we, who have been around for a long time, need to be here so they can see and hear what the program's all about. We mean a lot to newcomers, those of us that's been around here for some time. So go to meetings. You do count. We all do. God bless us, everyone. That was just something I wrote, and I just thought it sounded good when I was reading it again, and it reflects how I feel about this program and whatever. I was born down in Griffin. It's Cotton Mill Town. 1931. It makes me 85. And it was pool. I mean, there's no other way around it. We were really dirt poor, cotton mill folks. So we did. But I lived on the cotton mill village. You know, all the houses belonged to the mill except ours. Ours didn't belong to the mill. So everybody else has got all fixed up. The mill would fix them up, but ours didn't get fixed up. Outdoor toilets, all that kind of business, outhouses, all that kind of business. That goes back when I was a kid. It's a long time ago. But it was a peaceful time, you know. We was happy as kids. You know, we was poor, but we was happy. We played at night, you know, we'd play under the lights and whatever and all this kind of stuff. No fear, nothing going on, you know, that would endanger us or anything, you know. We just had all the neighborhood kids would play all kinds of stuff and whatever until somebody started hollering for us to get home. Get in his house. But anyway, this goes on, and I didn't even understand, you know, how other people lived at all, because no TV back then, you know. Radio was really in its infancy. We had one radio, a Zenith, that sat in the living room, and everybody would crowd around it to listen to American Album of the Familiar Music or Amos and Andy or somebody like that. So that was our life back then, and that's the way it stayed until, you know, I finally got into high school. And God knows, I got on the football team, I got on the basketball team, I got on the track team, got on all the teams. I was into sports from one end to the other. And I didn't know that people lived with carpet, lawns. God, I didn't know what people lived like that, because my side town it didn't. But anyway, it got to be, and you had these steak dinners, the football team did, had these steak dinners. It wasn't round steak. I mean, it was T-bones and things like that. God, I was living it up. I thought I was really, really something. But I've scored some touchdowns, and I've scored some home runs, and I've won some races, and I made a basket, too, and all this kind of good stuff. Everything except tennis and golf. They didn't play that over on my side of town. But anyway, it would have stayed away. And I'd have ended up in the mill. I mean, I was the first one in the whole family to ever graduate from high school. And everybody just thought I was just top notch, you know. I was going to be something, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But my destiny was for the mills. 27 cents an hour was what I was paying back then. And I worked in the mills during the summer vacations, and I worked part-time after I got out of high school. But I was also in the scouts, and all the basketball scouts and all this. And my scoutmaster was an electrician. And he said, "Jim, you want to come with me and be a helper?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll try anything to get out of the mill." And so it did, and I got interested in electricity and all this kind of stuff. And then along come the Korean War. But before that, we had the big war, World War II. And you talk about being a scared little kid. Everybody was scared. I mean, it was a whole aura of fear. And people like FDR. And oh, by the way, I met Eleanor Roosevelt one time when I was in the Navy up in New York outside the UN building. And she was hailing a cab, and I said, "Miss Roosevelt, may I take your picture?" She said, "Of course, young man." I was in uniform. She said, "Of course, young man, you can." So anyway, I got to meet some celebrity anyway. But anyway, the war was really on our minds. Things were shorter. You couldn't get sugar. Couldn't even get bubble gum. They took bubble gum away. So anyway, we got through that okay. But the Germans was coming across Europe, and the Japs were coming across the Pacific. And everybody just knew this was the end, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But not to be. America rose up and did, everybody knows what kind of job we've done. And I've always been so proud of our armed forces and all that kind of stuff. But when the Korean War come along, they were seeking to draft me, and I couldn't get what I wanted in the Army. Couldn't get into the Air Force, so I joined the Navy to see the world. And that was one of the best moves I ever made in my life, because I was going to be a pilot. I was going to be a jet pilot, man, and everything like that. And then it got down to the final test, and my eyes kept me out of it. And so anyway, was on the train fixing to head to Memphis to electronics school, aviation electronics school. And a partner of mine and I had been through all these tests together, and they come jerked him off the train to go to Pensacola. One of the saddest moments of my life, you know, he was going to fly. And I was going to electronics school. But as it turned out, I got a lot of flying in the Navy. That was all I'd done as a crew member. Electronics equipment and all that, bomb sites, gun sites, all that kind of good stuff. Radios, radar, the whole mess. And so that was the way I got out of Spalding County. And before that, I'd been out of the county but once. And that was on the football team when we played Gainesville or somewhere. But at any rate, it was quite a good, and it was a good youth. You know, everything was going good. You know, my mother, it was just, meant everything to us. My father had gone off to Hanford, Washington during the big war to build some atomic facility out there in Washington State, and he never... They never did get back again. And he wouldn't send him. He'd send some home every once in a while. And most of the time, my mother had to go back to work in the mill. Here's my mother going to work in my mill. My sister's going to work in the mill. I had three sisters. And I was the only boy, so he bet that I was spoiled rotten. So I've been on my own, you know, ever since I was a kid. So I didn't have any father to guide and direct me. But I still remember crying when they bought me a pair of short pants to put on, and I didn't want to put them pants on. I was about 6 years, so and crying. Now you can't get me out of them, you know. Here comes May. I'm gonna get into short pants, and I'm gonna stay there. But anyway, all that's got nothing to do with my drinking and all, but it is the way I was brought up, so it was a good, it was good. There was nothing in my life to lead me to drinking except my father. He was a weekend alcoholic, I guess you'd call him an alcoholic. The only liquor I'd ever tasted was when you had a toothache back then, at least in my side of town, they'd pack that tooth, that decayed tooth, with sugar and moonshine. That was the only taste, and boy, that moonshine did not taste all that great, I'm telling you. My father had stacks of it in a shift robe, and it exploded one night. We had a big mess on our hands there and stunk, good Lord of mercy. The only taste of alcohol I had was about 15 years old. I opened the refrigerator one time. My brother-in-law had put some beer in there. It was a Carling, and I can still remember thinking that. That's the prettiest looking bottle I ever seen in my life. Like I said, so I knocked the cap off of it back then, the caps, and I took a swallow of it. And I said, "Oh, wow, that is the best tasting stuff I've ever tasted in my life." I put the cap back on so he wouldn't know I'd been into it and all that. I didn't touch another drink, another alcohol after I got out of the Navy. Well, I did have one Drambuie over in Paris. I sat there on the sidewalk with a little bit thing about that big, you know, and I sat there and watched the people go by sipping on that little thing, whatever it was. I don't even know what goes in a Drambuie. Oh, and one other time, too, in New York, listening to Guy Lombardo. We had New Year's Eve and New Year's in New York. And so Guy Lombardo had a big thing going on, so I sat there with some guys and all that kind of stuff. We got free admission to these things. And so anyway, I did drink a little chocolate drink of some sort. I forgot what that was. But anyway, alcohol just wasn't with me. I was on the Navy teams, all the football teams, and all that kind of stuff. Everywhere I was at, we was even over in the Mediterranean and had a party on the beach in Beirut. And this guy come along with a camel, beat up old camel, flies all over the thing and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to ride that camel, you know, but we had a football game going on over there. And so I gave him 50 cents to let me get on that camel for somebody to take my picture. God knows, everybody decided they wanted their picture taken. That guy made a fortune, you know, just selling rides on that donkey, on that camel. And I was over at the park the other day, it reminded me of it, because they had a bunch of camels over there at the Shrine Fair and all that kind of business. But anyway, I got through the Navy, okay. I didn't drink, you know, drinking just wasn't part of my thinking. I didn't see any need to drink and all that kind of good stuff. I did see the value in alcohol, though, because those bottles were worth a bunch. And so you took a chance trying to get them back on board ship so you could sell them to your shipmates and all that. And they had a Pico on. That stuff, bottles down the Pico, and then I take it off when I got out to the ship. And so if they'd have caught me, you know, it'd have been Katie bar the door. But I didn't drink it. They did. But anyway, that's just a little haphazard way I was doing things back then. But it was exciting and all that kind of stuff, being away from Georgia and all this kind of business. But I love New York. I love Coney Island. I love the hot dogs. And I got a bug for travel and all this kind of stuff. I really like to travel and around the world and all this kind of business. And so anyway, come time to leave the Navy, I'd been, like I say, you know, I was lucky. I got into a position where I flew every day at Norfolk, you know, testing out planes and things like that. I was a crew member on them, and I'd check out the electronics gear and all that, and I'd still get flight pay, you know, and extra hazard duty pay and all that kind of stuff. So I did fairly well in that stage of my life as far as income goes. But by the way, I had to buy the first car that I learned how to drive in. We didn't have a car, so I had to buy one to learn how to drive. But a 52 Chevrolet, oh boy, that was a nice one. But at any rate, got out of the Navy and got into the business world. And things started to change. I really wanted to go to college, but I made a wrong decision there, one of many I made in my life, and I decided I'd go to business school, mainly because I just wanted to take it easy. I was smart enough to do most anything I wanted to do, and I didn't have to work hard to get passing grades for anything. But anyway, I met my wife at business school, and we got married. Coal miner's daughter, beautiful lady. Beautiful lady, both inside and out. West Virginia. But anyway, we had a lovely marriage. I met really a good marriage. I got into the business world. I was becoming an accountant. Got to working for handy pantry stores back then. There used to be lots of them all over the place. And they wanted to, one day they decided, everybody else has got a computer. Why don't we get a computer? Said, Jim, go get us a computer. Anyway, so off I go to IBM and not knowing anything about anything. And so next thing I know, we got this big old machine coming out there. We had to wire it up with boards and I guess hundreds of wires and all this kind of stuff. But it worked perfectly, I'm telling you. We really kicked out some stuff and all that kind of stuff. Well, we did so well. I got this accountant that came in from Miss Georgia Davis was circulating around, and he happened to pop in the handy pantry store and heard about all of this, and so he decided that I might want to join him to put in an installation out of Miss Georgia Davis, and so he was putting in a more modern computer out there, so. Okay, I said, yeah, I'll take a chance on that. So off we go. I'm now working for Miss Georgia Davis. And all this time, nobody knows what the hell you're doing. They're just interested in whatever you kick out. You know, as long as you get the job done, what you say, if you tell them what you can do and get it done, you know, they don't care what you do. So I had this tremendous freedom, but this accountant, he loved to drink. He loved to go to bars. I mean, this guy from North Carolina, and he was an advisor to setting up systems and accounting and computers and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, I get to going out with him at night. Bad decision. Well, first of all, we get to drinking at work and putting in things, and I'm just not used to doing all this drinking, but boy, I was having a good time. Women, good Lord of mercy. I never seen the like, and I was loyal to my wife. I mean, I love my wife. I don't need to worry about me straying. But I strayed, unfortunately. And I had a guilt complex and all this kind of business. And it started telling. We had 11 perfect years of a beautiful marriage. Beautiful kids, house in the country, two cars, boat, whole works, because I love to ski, and all this kind of business. And, it was just a nice life. I mean, I thought it'd go on forever and all that kind of stuff. Making a decent income. I never did make much money and all that kind of stuff. But I was making enough to get by back then. She didn't have to work if she didn't want to, but occasionally she would work for the... She had an in with the government, and she was smart enough that she could go to work anytime she wanted to and work for how long she wanted to and so on and so forth. But we had a good life, and I thought it would be just like that forever. But it didn't work out that way. So don't let me. Anyway, I just want you to understand that my life was good. And something come along that messed it up. Something I had no idea. See, I knew my father drank too much, but he'd blow out on the weekends. He'd work all week just as hard, a hard-working man. But come Friday night, boy, he would be out. Sometimes we'd see him again on Sunday. But he really drank heavily. And he was a fairly mean drunk. He never did abuse my mother except You know, just being the way he was, but it was disheartening to see him the way he was at times. So I swore I'd never be like that. In my mind, I swore I'd never, never be like my father. But anyway, it didn't turn out that way. So anyway, I got to running around with this guy, analyst, and things got more and more and more involved. You know, stayed out more and more and more. Started drinking more and more. And I got the way I expected to do it. And about that time, I got an offer to put in an installation at Muse's exclusive men's store down in Five Points in Atlanta. And I jumped at that. And so I was just going to be a consultant. I was just going to put in the system. That was all. But when I got in there and got programming and doing all this kind of stuff for the computer they got, the office manager died. He was just a young guy. And he was a good friend of mine. We'd become good friends, you know, during the work. But he died unexpectedly. And so they asked me if I would take over his duties and all this kind of stuff. So I did. I become the office manager and also the data processing manager and all kind of other managers that he was involved in. And so there was quite a system was putting in and all this. It was one of the fanciest, newest computers on the market. Wasn't another one like it anywhere, but one other one like it anywhere. And I had complete freedom. By this time, I was drinking, of course, like I say. And, I forgot. I went from Miss Georgia Davies over to Drugs Mutual. That was a drug supplier that wanted an installation put in, so I did that and all that. But I got off on bad terms there because one time I hired this lady to do some work for me at night, and she drank, left a bunch of beer bottles in there, but she was one of my drinking buddies. And but she was good at what she done, but she left a mess, beer bottles, and so they didn't like that. So I got mad and told them, you know, I was leaving. And they was glad of it. They helped me out the door. But anyway, I already been in contact with Muses, and so I went on to Muses and did what I was talking about. But I was running around with all these other computer managers and data processing managers and all these people doing programming and whatever. And nobody knew what the hell was doing, you know. They couldn't look over our shoulder or anything. We just could come and go and do what we wanted to. And they didn't particularly care until one day the boss got a little worried about his computer and said, Jim, said, how about going to an AA meeting? I'm worried about you a little bit. He was a Philadelphia lawyer. I really didn't care for him too much, but he saved my life, really. He said, I'm not going to an AA meeting. He said, I got a compatriot over here, one of my associates, and he said, go with him to an AA meeting. And I wanted to tell him to stick it so bad you couldn't see straight. But I was a bar drinker. By then, I was having trouble at home and all this kind of business, and my wife come downtown one time. I'd already left home and living with another woman. And my wife come downtown and wanted to talk to me. And I said, well, I'll meet you at this bar over here and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, this is a woman I really loved. And so she did. She met me in this bar and all this kind of stuff. Of course, I had to meet in the bar. And she said, Jim, said, come home. I love you, and I want you to come home. The children want you to come home. They're praying for you to come home. We're eager for you to come home. Just please, please, please come home. She's doing this in a bar, and I'm doing like that, you know. And I tell her, I said, and she said, all I want you to do is just quit drinking. Told her I couldn't. I never forget it. As long as I live, I'll never forget it. Her eyes are just shining, you know, sort of teary. and she was looking me right in the face. And the light just went out of her eyes. And she gathered up a bag, got off the little stool, started walking toward the door. She got about halfway to the door, and she turned back, and she looked at me, and just went. And that was it. Never would I be able to recover that love. Never. And I don't know how many of us have ever been truly, truly loved by anybody, but that woman loved me. I mean, she really loved me, and I knew it. I always knew it. And I was proud of it and all this, and I still couldn't give it up because I wanted to drink. No other reason, just wanted to drink. That stuff is powerful. If you think that you're going to whoop alcohol by just saying I'm going to quit, you know, and that's going to be it, you got another thing coming. If you're an alcoholic like I was a functioning alcoholic. I worked every day. I had to kite checks at the bank right across the street. And I had to be on the ball to keep up fronts, you know. I had to make those computers work. I had to make everything balance out because I was also doing all the accounting. And I could do all that, but I just couldn't quit drinking. And there's bars downtown all over the place, and they loved me, and I loved them. And it was exciting, and it was there. And then I had accepted that as part of my life until all at once. He said, go to a meeting. See, there's turning points that come in all our lives when they could go either way. What if I'd said, stick it? Do you think I'd be standing up here? I don't think so. But I didn't have anything else lined up or anything like that, and by then I didn't have a reputation as a drinker, so I would have had a hard time getting another job as good as the one I had. So I said, well, yeah, I'll go to the meeting. So I went to this meeting, Norcross, a little house on the corner. And they gave me a white chip. I didn't ask for it. I just sat there. You know, they gave it to me. Well, I took it. I knew what the hell, you know. I wasn't embarrassing anybody. I just took the white chip. But I thought these people were crazy. I thought they were chanting. You know, somebody had introduced himself. I'm so-and-so. I'm an alcoholic. And they go, hey, so-and-so. And I thought they were chanting. I thought, God, man. One guy talking about he sat down in the grate under the road drinking and all this kind of business. The other one, you know, got drunk, drinking imaginary drinks and all this kind of stuff. I said, God, what kind of loony being am I in? You know, so anyway, I was through that. No more AA for me. But anyway, that white chip was in my pocket on the way. And I rode a bus back and forth, commuted back and forth. Then Greyhound had a line back and forth to Marietta every day. And I rode that in, rode it back, because my license had been taken away forever. They did. They took my license away forever. And I wasn't going to ever get it back. But that's another story. But and I got to riding back all in the dark on that bus. And I put my hand in my pocket and I felt that white chip. There again, you know, there are points, you know, that if not taken one way, it's disaster. But I looked at that, I felt that white chip, and I said, you know, I'm so tired of people fussing at me and getting on to me about drinking and all this. What I'm going to do, I'm going to do this 90 meetings in 90 days that they're talking about, and that'll show people how hard I tried. And then I'm going to go two blocks away and to drink at lunch instead of close in. I'll go way on the other side over there, you know, I'll be more careful with my drinking. That's what I was thinking. So I'm an honest guy, you know, and I was going to do it honestly, so I'll be damned. That white tip, well, before I did have two blue ribbons before I got on that bus that night, two tall blue ribbons. There was a bar right across the street from the bus station. But anyway, that chip now is on my dresser drawer. And guess what's lined up all the way across my dresser drawers? Chip after chip after chip after chip after chip. Whole basket of blue ones. I'm going to have to bring those in so they can use them, whatever. But just by feeling of that white chip in my pocket, just by them giving it to me when I didn't ask for it, but coming to meetings when I didn't even want anything to do with it, God, I'm a lucky guy. I'm a blessed guy. How proud I am of this organization that would accept somebody like me and cause all this uproar in my life that turned out to be so good. I'm telling you, God, I wished I could tell you all the stuff that's happened, but then I'm missing out on a little. I made all these notes, and I ain't even looked at them. I got things on there to really tell you about, like about the time they took my license away forever, but they passed a law in the legislature where you could get them back after 2 years. So I had a brother-in-law that was a lawyer, and so we went down and got my license back after 2 years. And I was in a meeting one day, and of course everybody had motorcycles back then. Outside this building, there'd be two rows of motorcycles, and everybody had motorcycles. I thought it was a requirement for AA. So anyway, I bought a motorcycle. And, so anyway, that's. But then again, that's still another story. But I was in my car going to. Across the bridge coming back from work. You could go back and forth to work on this license that they gave you, this temporary license that they'd give you after 2 years. And it had big purple letters on it, HV. HV. And so the cops had a roadblock set up on the bridge across Chattahoochee. And they stopped me. And they said, see your license. Pulled it out. The cop looked at it and he said, HV? What's HV? And the cop walked up behind him and said, man, that's a handicapped veteran. Don't you know anything? Habitual violator. He saluted me. I saluted him back. Drove on over. But anyway, that's that. I just thought that would just catch me on, didn't it? But I've had so many good, great experiences and all that kind of good stuff. And I'm running. Let me see if there's anything on here that I really don't forget. Oh, I'll tell you one sad thing. See, that was funny. But I got stuff that's not so funny. I was having all this trouble and all this, and my mother was still alive and all this, but she got sick and sick and sicker and all this kind of stuff. She'd stay with my sister and all this. And so one day, I was in the office, and my son-in-law called and said, your mother died last night. I said, no. But it wasn't unexpected and all that kind of stuff. And then I got down to Griffin and all that kind of stuff. And my sisters told me. She said, the last words your mother ever said was, you girls take care of Jim. He's going to need you. I got to carry that around for the rest of my life. But I'm praying that by being in this program and doing what I've done the last 37 years of my life, that in some way, well, I hope she's able to understand, you know, and say, I don't know how heaven works. I don't know about all that. But if there is a heaven up there and she can't see, I just hope she's proud of me for what I've done, you know, in AA and how my heart is now. God, what an adventure it's been. What an adventure. Got to do the things that I wanted to do. I'm now on good terms with my family. I can look at them now, and I see that respect in the eyes that I had lost. See, I look people in the eye when I talk to them. And I get their feeling, you know. That's where you get, where you're being understood or not, by looking people in the eye. And it's such a pleasure to see what's in my children's eyes, what's in my ex-wife's eyes. I do things for them. Anything they do, they call on me to do, and I'm glad to do it, proud to do it. And they're happy to see me. And when somebody's happy to see you, that's really a change from the way it used to be. And one of my daughters jumped out the window one day and I come home drunk. But I wasn't abusive or nothing like that. I was just a drunk. I didn't go in cussing, fussing, fighting, and do all that kind of stuff. Just drunk. Pitiful. Just pitiful. One day I didn't even make it in the door. Just halfway in the door. And the neighbors and all could see and all this kind of business, you know. I mean, pitiful. Alcohol done that to me. I'm a proud man. I've always been a proud man. That's what poor people do, you know, they're proud. And I let that happen. Alcohol caused that to happen. And I let it. In spite of being so smart, so intelligent, so all this kind of stuff. It beat the hell out of me. I got no excuse for it. But I sure can tell you. It was the best moment of my life when I knocked on that door of Reba's. I looked in the book to see where in the world I could go. So at the time I didn't have a license, so my wife had to pick me up. So I picked this place, of course, the old green building. And I picked that place, you know, because that was convenient to her coming out of Cherokee County, which I moved to. I lived in Decatur. It was a dry county. Well, it went wet. I moved out of the wet county and moved up to Cherokee, a dry county. And I'm an alcoholic. See, I'd kind of thinking that don't cut it, I'm doing. But anyway, I can't begin to tell you all the run-ins I had with the law and all that. I had 13 DUIs. Because I was a party guy. I loved the party, I'm telling you. I still do it for that matter. But anyway. But anyway, Kool-Aid don't cut it like Bruce used to. Anyway, I told somebody one day, I said, I just signed up for 37 years. I got one more year to go, and then I'm going to get up. Not to be, no desire for alcohol. It was taken away. It's hard for people to believe. I do this jail meeting on Thursday night, and these guys are in there, and all this kind of stuff. And I keep telling them, they say, man, I can't quit drinking, man. All that kind of good stuff. So I want it too bad. I enjoy it too much and all this kind of stuff. And I tried to get across the point that it will come a time if you follow the tenets of this program, do the steps, read the big book, go hang out with other alcoholics, go to meetings. You know, there'll come a time when that desire to drink and drug will leave you. It's hard to get that point across. One guy says, well, I've been going to AA and all this kind of stuff, I'm not happy quitting drinking. I said, well, you're not supposed to be happy. It's a hard transition, man. You know, it's a hard transition, but you've got to have the faith and the belief in what's been shown to you by other people's experiences. You know, that there will come a time when they'll be over. You will not want to drink and drug. And that's my case. I've traveled all over the world. And I've been in the breweries over in England and Scotland and all that kind of stuff. And they put these big well, not big, but glasses of scotch in front of it. 20-year-old scotch. I love scotch. I grew to love it in the business world. That's what really got to me, because everybody else, you know, did have one. I'd have three or four. But at any rate, I love that scotch. And the people would gang around my table knowing I didn't drink because I was sober at the time. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to be in Scotland and in Ireland and all these other places. But because I love to travel, and I even went to Iceland. Anybody, who in the hell wants to go to Iceland? You know, not too many people. But anyway, I did, because I'd just go anywhere, because I love to travel. You know, when in the Navy, I just got used to it. Been in every state in the Union, all of, I don't matter about all that. But the thing is, I was able to do what I wanted to do, because I was sober. You people had kept me sober all these years. And it was you people, I guarantee you. There had to be something interesting here for me to stick around as long as I have. I mean, there had to be some interesting people. I called some of them up today when I got to rambling through some of my records and all, just because I was talking. And I couldn't resist it. I had to call them up to tell them how much I appreciated their friendship over the years. And it was good to hear from them. Good to be back in touch, and it's been that way. There's been so much help given me just by people being here. See, I don't know most of you, but boy, I look around every Saturday night, and I love to see the same faces time and time and time again. That means the program's working. You're where you ought to be. I see happiness. And when I go to the other meetings and I hear people talking about their experiences, you know, it's just thrilling to me. That's a thrilling program. It's exciting to be sober. I mean, you can do anything you can dream up within your power. And it's just so good to have that freedom and peace. You're at peace with the world. But you can fail. You can fall flat on your face and know that you tried the hardest and the best that you could. And you can still feel good about yourself. You can have bad things happen, and you can survive. How wonderful is that? That strength that this program gives you. Above all, gratitude. I hope we give God credit for this program, because I certainly believe it's His creation in one way or the other. God, and the feeling that I have. When I walk through that door, I get a new feeling. You know, it's just, and by the way, I was the first one to ever walk through that door. You know why? Because Mike Wells was drilling it into the pavement. It wasn't in a roof or nothing. He was just drilling that door in. He said, "Hold this door, Jim, while I drill it." And so he did. And I run outside and I jumped back in, you know, just so I could say I've been in, come through the door. That don't mean nothing to nobody but me, but anyway. But I do crazy things like that. I mean, I love this program, and I love the people in it. I mean, you can go to a meeting anywhere you want to, and it's just a good feeling to belong there. Oh, God, I'm telling you, I don't know what my life would have been if I hadn't made that, if I hadn't felt that white chip in my pocket on that bus ride home. What if I hadn't done that? What if somebody had cussed me out the first night I was here and told me to be quiet or do this, do that, because I was belligerent. I didn't want to be here. But sitting through those meetings, slowly something started to rise in me, and it was a spirit that's still there. It grows and grows and grows, seeing what people are doing with their lives. I've seen hopeless cases blossom. Happiness come to those that were sad. And I just can't imagine, you know, how much we owe to the people that kept this program going over the years. It's up to you to keep it going, all you young people. It's up to you. The responsibility descends to you on your shoulders. You got to keep it going. You got to help other alcoholics. That's the way it works. So many helped me that I was going to call some names, but if I did, I'd leave somebody out and I'd just kick myself in the butt on the way home. But anyway, just know that you're in the right place, and just by being here, you're helping somebody. You're helping me, nobody else. Anyway, it's a joyous program, and it's a happy program, and God bless this place because it has been a lifesaver for me. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Let's give Jim another hand. Y'all, let's give Jim another hand. All right, that was all right. That was all right.